and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. Today, we conclude our month-long series of presentations from the Arctic Imperative Summit hosted by the Alaska Dispatch. This week, the panel discussion focuses on sustainable development in the Arctic. Publisher of the Alaska Dispatch, Alice Rogoff, served as host of the four-day summit recorded at Alyeska Resort in Girdwood, August 24th through the 27th.
Okay, before the panel gets seated, I want to say a word about the fellow who will be moderating it, Scott Borgerson. President Grimson talked about an aha moment, and I know he didn't mean it in this sense, but I'm going to talk for a second about my aha moment on the whole subject of Arctic development, which came from Scott Borgerson. And if any of you here in the room have not read the piece he wrote in the Journal of Foreign Affairs, Scott, in what year? 2005. It is, to me, the seminal piece of writing yet on this subject, and probably so until Scott writes an update to it, which he's promised me he's going to do soon. In a nutshell, Scott saw the picture that people like President Grimson and probably Russia had been seeing for quite some time, that the melting sea ice was going to cause, excuse the pun, a sea change in the world's commerce patterns, in marine transportation at least. And as a result, he has spent the years since then developing all kinds of new knowledge, which he has put to use in both the public and private sectors. So if that isn't enough to make you think he's able to moderate this panel, I can't add anything more. But he's graciously playing the role of moderator rather than speaker, because I believe he can integrate what everybody else needs to say with great skill. So, Scott, please take it.
Thank you for that very kind introduction, Alice. And President Grimson, Governor Murkowski, Governor Treadwell, General Ralston, Vice Admiral Zunkov, all the distinguished people who are here today and friends in Alaska, it's a real pleasure to be back here. And before beginning, let me just add my voice to congratulate Alice and her staff on what is truly an exciting and fabulous conference. You know, Charlie had his angels, and Alice has hers. There's a cadre of really impressive lieutenants running around here. Tracy, Megan, Jenny, and I'd like to acknowledge their efforts as well, because this conference would not be such a well-oiled machine without all of their assistance. Before introducing our distinguished panelists to talk about the Arctic's emerging economy and resources, I'd like to say that this feels a little bit like the great diplomatic moment in history of At the Creation. I don't know if you've read that book, but we are truly experiencing a historic moment here. We are at a moment where history is bending, where heads of state come to talk to us about how literally the future is changing before our eyes, how the state of Alaska is changing, how the Arctic is an emerging market. It is truly an exciting moment. I hope you all feel that sense of pioneer, of being in the frontier of Alaska at this moment in time, and playing the important role that we have as the Americans in the room of providing a voice of leadership, of vision, of entrepreneurism, on this very important issue, which has become a great passion of mine. And I'm very pleased that Alice invited me to come back here this morning. Thank you. So I'd like to just quickly, of course, point out that Arctic energy, and in particular in Alaska, has been a source of wealth for this state and might be, of course, the crucial emerging issue as it comes to imperatives in the opening Arctic. We have key stakeholders on this panel, thought leaders on this panel who will present sort of a number, I think, of thought-provoking ideas and their perspectives. And, of course, as we heard and saw, Deputy Secretary from the federal government and the head of Shell sitting next to each other on a panel with friendly tension there, but tension nonetheless. This is a politically loaded issue as well, of course, that comes with all kinds of nuances and color to it, including the presidential election ongoing right now. And so that makes it just a fabulously terrific and juicy topic to have a panel on this morning. When NYMEX closed on Friday, West Texas Intermediate was trading at $96 a barrel and Brent at $113 a barrel. And I point that out, of course, the economics of what all this means as well. Very much look forward to hearing our panelists who will present their different perspectives on this issue of oil and gas development in the Arctic. So with no further ado, I'll quickly run through each person's bio before giving the podium first to Admiral Ostebo. So Rear Admiral Tom Ostebo is the commander of the 17th District. For those not familiar with Coast Guard jurisdictions, that's all of Alaska, which is a massive area of jurisdiction. He assumed his duties in May of 2011, and he's responsible for all Coast Guard operations in the state, including protecting life and property, enforcing federal laws and treaties, preserving living marine resources, and promoting national security. We'll also hear from the Honorable Charlotte Brower, who is elected as the mayor of the North Slope Borough in November 2011. She's also served on the North Slope Borough Assembly and the North Slope Borough School District. Next, we'll hear from Hugh Putkatak, who is the chairman of the Board of Directors of the Ulnik Native Corporation, the village corporation for the community of Wainwright on the North Slope. He's been instrumental in developing the strategic direction guiding the organization's steady growth. And today, the corporation's subsidiaries work worldwide in government contracting. Also, Crawford Potkatuk is the chairman of the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, which represents the business interests of 11,000 Inupiaq shareholders. He serves as the corporate treasurer and is a senior vice president of shareholder and community programs and has served on the ASRC Executive Committee since 2000 and the ASRC Investment Committee since 2008. Charles Evinger is the director of the Energy Security Initiative at Brookings and previously was a senior advisor at the International Resources Group, where he advised more than 50 governments on energy policy. And last but not least, Ed Crooks is the U.S. Energy and Industry Editor of the Financial Times based in New York. So we have six speakers and about 85 minutes, give or take, before this wraps up. So I appreciate everyone being brisk and prompt in their time at the podium. And Admiral Ostebo, the podium is yours. Thank you.
Good morning. It's great to be here. And Alice, thank you very much for the invite and the opportunity to speak in front of such a august group of folks. And I will keep my comments very short because I know I'm more interested in the Q&A session and a little bit of interaction with the audience. First, I'll start off with the Arctic Imperative. And I was thinking about that when Alice asked for me to be here. I think the interim imperative is worth pondering a little bit. When you think about that word, it means obligation. It means unavoidable. It means inevitable. And when I think of the Arctic and when I think of and listen to the folks talk today, how true that is, that we have an obligation about something that's happening that's out of our control in a lot of ways. In other words, as Americans, we tend to think we can move a few levers or get involved at some point or show up late in the game and solve a lot of problems. I think the Arctic is going to prove to be a little bit different, and I think it's time now, and time critical, and certainly in my job, it's a today problem. It's probably a yesterday problem that we're just now focusing on today, but as a lot of folks think about the Arctic, they come up here, they do a study, they may go back home and do something else. It's a 24/7 real-time problem for the people of Alaska. I think it's a real-time imperative for the nation to get our arms around the things that are going on in the Arctic. And I think it's critically important that we understand that we do not control it. The rest of the world has a vote here, and we are late to the table, as many folks have said earlier today. We talked about a cause for action. And I think it was Scott earlier, or David, I can't remember which one, talked a little bit about Neil Armstrong, loss of him. It's the first thing I thought of when he was lost, besides the fact, I remember sitting there in 1969 watching him walk on the moon with the rest of my family on black and white TV on three channels that we had. But and I had hair, and a lot of other things were different. But when I think about that time, and I think about the cause for action that was put out, the foresight, and quite frankly, an idea that was pitched as a good idea without a whole lot of detail behind it, and somewhat of a trust me, this is an inevitable thing. As soon as he was lost, I thought about the Arctic in that same context. And I thought about the fact that things are moving environmentally, things are moving naturally, things are moving politically, things are moving economically, that we simply don't realize, or we should be realizing, that are happening, that are again outside of our control. So when I look at the Arctic strategically from the position I sit in, there are certain decisions that need to be made today, like yesterday perhaps, about how we want the Arctic to look in the future. And I think there is a middle road here. I think there's a way to find a sustainable, environmentally friendly way to move forward, where the United States can take a leadership position, as we should, as one of the Arctic nations, as we should as a nation with the largest EEZ in the world, as we should as a nation with both Atlantic and Pacific interests. It's time now to start making some of those critical strategic decisions. Above my pay grade, but clearly an observation for me right now. Operationally, the today problem for me is there's a lot of activity going on in the Arctic, and I only see a very small amount of what's going on. I see the numerator, and I don't know what the denominator looks like in this equation. So as an engineer, I'm trying to understand what's going on in the Arctic. I do know, as of my brief on Friday morning, my operational brief on Friday morning, there were 95 ships essentially between Prudhoe Bay and Wainwright operating offshore. About 45 of those were registering to us as research vessels of one sort or another. Healy, the one Coast Guard icebreaker, was among them. What everybody else is looking at, what they're doing out there, I don't think we have full visibility on. I think we should have full visibility on that. That many ships also means that there's probably 1,500 people offshore. Something goes wrong offshore today, literally as I'm standing here, elisions, collisions, groundings, shipboard fires that create problems. How do we respond to that as a nation? How do we get up there and make a move? How do we do the obligations that the Coast Guard has for safety of life at sea? How do we ensure the environment is protected from one of those calamities today? I can tell you it's difficult. But I can tell you that the Coast Guard, thanks to great support from my senior leadership, has decided to lean forward into that. And for the first time in almost 100 years, we have a presence above the Arctic on a 24/7 basis, with an air station that we've opened up seasonally in Barrow this summer with two H-60 helicopters. We've already done several search and rescue cases in just their first few weeks being open, but are making a reemergence up there on a permanent basis so that we can engage with the local community. And I've had the great pleasure not too long ago with Admiral Zunkoff and Mayor Brower to fly her around on some of our aircraft. Our folks are doing a great job in Barrow, interacting with the community and helping in many ways. So we're leaning forward operationally for all the hazards and all the threats that we know that are coming with increased maritime activity. On a tactical level, I lose a lot of sleep when I look at the activity that I know of that's going on, and then I get glimpses of other activity that's happening that's not necessarily within my control or within my purview, and primarily across the Northern Sea Route. And I look at the amount of ships that are moving from northern Russia to market. When I look at gas condensates that are moving through the northern Sea Route, when I look at everything from adventure traffic to cruise ship traffic that's going on up there, I worry a lot on a tactical basis that this today problem that the Coast Guard faces is happening, and it's kind of spinning a little bit out of control. My colleagues on the east coast of the U.S., whether that's the coast of New England or whether it's the Gulf Coast or the coast of Florida, have orders of magnitude more capability, more presence, and sustainment in their regions than we do here in Alaska. So we have thousands of miles of coastline with two little helicopters sitting up there. We have thousands of miles of coastline, and we got a call not too long ago over towards Nome, between Nome and Portlaoise, for a search and rescue case. It still took us a day to get there. It's tough to tread water in the Arctic while someone comes and gets you on that event. The Coast Guard has 11 statutory missions. I'm not going to go into all of them, but the commandant, I think, puts them in pretty clear buckets. We protect the United States from hazards that may come from the sea. We protect people who operate, make a living, and work on the sea, and we protect the sea itself. pretty tough to do with just a couple of helicopters and a bunch of motivated Americans that are up there. But the problem is today, and I think if this organization, this forum can be used as an opportunity to put forward a cause for action, if we can be the voice that gets the U.S. to start looking at the Arctic not as a cost sink or as a cost center for U.S. activity, but quite frankly as an investment. And we've heard a little bit from some of the investment folks here earlier, but strategically there's an opportunity to make investments in the Arctic that have huge payoffs for the United States, whether that's, you know, the 30, 40, 50 billion barrels of oil that we talk about that are out there at almost, say, an average $100 a barrel. You pretty quickly get those extra zeros on there and start talking trillions of dollars of resources that are available to the United States. How we develop them and whether we develop them is a big decision. It's a national decision that needs to be made, but it cannot be ignored. And up until this point, I think from a national perspective, we've done some ignoring of the issue up in the Arctic. My closing comment here is I was reminded when my kids were young, they used to say, "Ready or not, here we come," when they would play their games. I think when I look at the Arctic, it's kind of the same way. Ready or not, America, here we come, Arctic. And that is moving forward. It's great to have the international community here. And President Grimson has great comments. And I really took down a lot of notes and look to you for as a leader of the international community as we go forward through the Arctic Council and other places. But I look forward very much to interaction and to comments from everybody here in the audience today. Thank you very much for a short moment at the mic, and ready or not, here we come. Thank you.
Thank you, Amaras. About 95 vessels and 1,500 people on the water this morning in the American Arctic. That is incredible. Mayor Brower, let's hear about that helicopter ride.
Parlez-y. I will tell about that story. I had a briefing with the Coast Guard, and I was told that we would take off, and Admiral Sunikoff and Rear Admiral Ostebo and safety and two pilots, and I'll be sitting close to the door, and they'll be opening the door and closing the door. Of course, that's natural. So we left, and on the left side, I'm watching, because I'm interested for our search and rescue, the heating, the part where the infrared, and I wanted to see if there's caribou or even fish in that picture. So I'm watching, and then we're just about over Nuiqsut when the safety officer stepped over and starts switching around some things, and I'm sitting there, and just I had my headphone on, and I'm like, okay, I won't be nervous, because he's right next to me, and all of a sudden, 75 feet to the airport, he opens the door, and he pivots his knee, and he holds on to the bar. He's full gear, he's connected, while I'm strapped. Then I got reminded of our favorite movie, The Guardian. Kevin Costner did the same. And I'm like, oh no, he's going to fall off, because Kevin Costner put his hand out before he fell into the ocean. But there was no ocean. We were landing. So that's the story of my brief introduction of flying on your Healy. So I did ask though Admiral Sunikoff that any of the landings that you do land in the North Slope, if our conditions aren't right, then you and I will work together with the United States. And we both have come to that conclusion. Good morning. Thank you for the invitation, Alice. I'm not sure if you do know, my niece is Blessing Brower, and my daughter is Mary Jo. She's worked closely with the two in purchases of hand-sewed materials, and they're known worldwide. And through that, I want to thank you, because the two that I'm talking about are unemployed, and they use the skills that were taught by their grandmother. So thank you. As you all know, I'm Charlotte E. Brower, mayor of the North Slope Borough, and I'm a wife of a whaling captain, but first and foremost, I am a daughter of a reindeer herder from a small village of Selawik next door to Kotzebue. I was not born on land. I was born on sea, en route from our hometown, Selawik, into Kotzebue, and my mother gave birth to me right before we beached in the sea of Kotzebue, which is Chukchi Sea, and right into the lands of Kotzebue. So I've always said I was never born on land. I meant to be on sea. We have together, Eugene and I, have 6 children and 23 grandchildren, and we raised our children to be very strict, and they're very strict with their children. My husband is a whaling captain. We have crew of 19. He is a boss out on sea. I am his boss on land. Because for 19 men that we're responsible for, we get under what we call the boyas, the ones that have to learn the trades of becoming a whaling captain. So it's my responsibility to make sure that they're disciplined and that they're taught the ropes, and my husband takes over out on sea. For over a century, we have lived in the front lines of resource development. Today, I would like to share our perspective and hopefully give you a better sense of who we are. Even before Prudhoe Bay, we were part of the process that accompanies energy development in the Arctic. We remember when the wildcatters and the federal government explored the area that became the NPRA. Scars from that exploration remains. The land at heart of Alaska's economy is home of our people. As development has occurred in our homeland, we have watched. We have participated. We have helped. We have learned. And we have been changed, much of which has been to the good. It is an exciting time with new activity in the Arctic, but it also a time of concern. We have reminded the many visitors this summer that we are not just a battleground for competing agendas or propagandas. We have the most to lose from these mistakes. We have also much to gain if it's done right. We are eager to partner, share our experience, and work collaboratively. And you listen to Commissioner Dan Sullivan spoke as an example of our willingness to partner and work collaboratively. The North Slope Borough recently entered into a memorandum of agreement with the State of Alaska Department of Natural Resources. This MOU is an important first step in enabling the state and the local government to work together in areas relating to permitting in the oil and gas development. And this is happening on the North Slope. And we welcome these opportunities. But be clear, we are much less eager to participate if we are an afterthought or not even at the table. We are the experts on the Arctic. We have subsisted off the tundra and ocean for thousands of years. The Arctic is changing both environmentally and economically. So the idea of an Arctic imperative is quite different today than it is even 10 years ago. In the past, we have focused our efforts and attention on protecting the ocean and subsistence practices. by using events like this to voice our concerns. My administration believes in responsible development. Responsible development is just no spills. It is also a meaningful tax base. It is a fair share, which doesn't exist through revenue sharing. It is true workforce development and jobs for both Alaskans and our local people. There are no shortcuts to long-term stability. It is imperative we provide our residents with the best education, technology, and opportunities possible. It is imperative that we supply our residents with quality health care. It is imperative we provide safe and affordable housing. Local participation has made onshore development successful on the North Slope. As Arctic offshore exploration goes forward, similar attention to local needs and concerns will create conditions for success in the OCS. The people of the North Slope expects three things: a seat at the table in the Arctic planning, a fair and stable share of the revenues generated from the development, and development that find ways to support the culture and communities of the North Slope. The North Slope Borough insists that the U.S. government to include an Alaska Native on every U.S. Arctic policy negotiating team. We are very pleased that the Canadian government selected an Inuit woman to chair the Arctic Council. The federal government must collaborate with Arctic residents and local government to develop comprehensive U.S. Arctic policy. One way is through the newly created new Arctic Policy Commission. Thank you, Representative Reggie Jewell, Representative Bob Heron, for making that possible, and other state legislatures, which will take up issues such as the law of the sea, the Arctic OCS land claims resolution, which we still have to resolve with the United States, being Russia has already claimed the waters, as they once say. The International Marine, IMO, and Polar Code, those are just a few issues that this new policy, new Arctic Policy Commission would discuss. There are opportunities on the interagency working group that Deputy Secretary Hayes is spearheading, and we've heard that, and the pipeline corridor planning efforts of BLM. As a cooperating agency with BLM, we are working to address our concerns with the preferred initiative, alternative B2. And I know that the BLM is aware of the alternative B2, and a speaker will be talking about that here soon. We'll still need to address the legacy well, cleanup, pipeline corridor planning, and other ways to improve the end result of this process. The $5 million provided to support the Arctic Council's environment projects is insufficient to properly address these needs. OCS revenue sharing will be critical for funding local and state agencies to pursue needed studies and sustain local communities. We cannot prepare for the level of activity and changes that are occurring in the Arctic without sources of necessary funding. Finally, as to our third concern for our culture, our leaders long ago recognized that the world is not black and white. There are lots of gray out in the Beaufort and Chukchi Sea, and most solutions are not as simply as saying yes or no. Money is important, but it is not definitive. There needs to be a balance for our culture and our people. Our elders engaged with those who had competing interests, and they and we adapted. To cope, we fought to create the North Slope Borough, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, and many other organizations, programs, and corporations that now protect and sustain our people. Adapting is not a threat to our culture. It is what we have done to protect it. Residents of the North Slope have always viewed the world through a different cultural lens, and sometimes that has led others to conclude that we are anti-development. This is simply not the case. It takes time to create a level of trust between parties and with different cultural and economic perspective. The broad goal of the North Slope Borough is to maintain a healthy environment supporting Inupiaq subsistence practices, which while at the same time promoting economic growth and responsible resource development. We have been host to many visitors again this summer, and since my being elected to the seat as a mayor of the North Slope Borough has brought much more visitors to know what this leader would say in defense of her people. We appreciate the interest and opportunity to educate our guests who don't know or understand the Arctic. Now it's time to take stock and think about making changes. It is time for us as leaders to step up. Economy and ecology share the same root, eco or home. A healthy economy and healthy ecology go hand in hand, together like bread and water, the marine mammals and the sea. If you think economic development is an environmental problem, try poverty. We all have a stake in doing things right, and one who's most affected are our elders, our young people, our children that trust us. In that spirit, we need to work together at all levels. We need to identify both the impacts and benefits and find the right balance and benefits that must be defined in a holistic and spiritual sense, not the cash flow. I pledge to you that my team and I will work with our governor, state legislatures, congressional leaders, our Coast Guard, and of course, our Arctic neighbors. Thank you for coming, Iceland, Finland. Benefits of development and sustaining our cultural and social well-being. And thank you to Alice for bringing this astounding conference together. This is one that the whole world is watching at this time. And I want to thank you personally again for your good deeds that you have done for my people. Thank you very much.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with the Honorable Charlotte Brower, Mayor of the North Slope Borough. She was recorded speaking at the Arctic Imperative Summit on August 26th. The next person to speak on sustainable development in the Arctic was Ed Crooks, U.S. Industry and Energy Editor for the Financial Times.
Thank you very much indeed. Thanks a lot for that. Thank you very much indeed, Alice, for inviting me to speak. Thank you very much for laying on such wonderful weather. I have to say this is great. I'm very much enjoying this. Really reminds me of a good British summer, so you're very much making me feel at home here. So thanks very much indeed for that. I'm conscious we're quite short of time, and we want to get on to some questions, so I'll keep this very brief. There's just one thing I thought it was kind of important to raise with you, just when we think about the perspective of the way the rest of the world is looking at Alaska and following up some of the thoughts about the way that investors are thinking about Alaska. And I think it's really encapsulated in a fact that was discussed a little bit yesterday about how North Dakota has now overtaken this state as the second largest producer of oil in the United States. And I think it's well worth thinking about why that is and what the implications of that are. A good starting point I would like to commend to all of you is Mitt Romney's energy plan, which he launched last week. I think it's available on his campaign website. It's well worth a look. Very interesting, actually, quite a meaty document, 21 pages long, quite a lot of stuff in there, quite a lot, I think, which may be quite welcome in this state, including talk about transferring control of natural resource development on federal lands from the federal government to the states. And so something, again, which we've talked about quite a bit already this morning, will be very welcome. Something I think which should make people pause here, though, is his discussion of energy independence. One of the things that he's talked about and the kind of the big overarching theme of his campaign, really, when it comes to energy, is the idea that the United States can be independent in energy by the end of what he hopes would be his second term in 2020. And he cites various studies and bits of work that people have done on energy independence to show why this is a plausible and a realistic ambition for him to have. And one of the best, and again, if you can kind of click through on the website and get to this, one of the best bits of work on that is done by a guy called Edward Morse at Citigroup. He's the head of commodities research there, used to be an official at the Energy Department, so on, a very kind of illustrious career he's had in energy economics. And he breaks down a lot of detail about the expected growth or the potential growth of oil supply in North America. And he talks about Mexico and Canada and indeed the US being able to have really very dramatic increases in oil production over the coming decade. And when you look at his numbers, Alaska is actually a very small part of that story. And the big thing, of course, that he's talking about there is shale oil. And he's talking about, no doubt familiar to everyone in this room, but the way that there's been an absolute revolution in oil supply and oil production in the lower 48, just really in the past sort of 3 years or so. It's been a very, very dramatic, very rapid change. People talk about it as a kind of technological disruption, like the way that the PC hit the computer market or something like that. It has been really kind of unexpected, but the way that oil companies have been able to deploy horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing together to kind of perfect those techniques, to do them in a more sophisticated and cost-effective way to unlock these very large oil reserves that were previously uncommercial, has been a very, very impressive thing to see. It's affected, as I was saying, North Dakota. North Dakota is kind of the heart of it, but it's really a lot of the country, a lot of the states across the lower 48 are being affected by this now. We're seeing it in Colorado, in Texas, even in Ohio, a lot of places that, to be frank, are, for a lot of reasons, much easier to operate in, much lower cost than Alaska is. If you look, I was looking at a study the other day of the cost structure of what kind of oil price you need to make your development commercially viable in the lower 48 across these kind of shale oil plays. And there's a range, and the range is typically between $40 and $70. So even at the top end, the most expensive of these plays need about $70 per barrel oil. And so that's pretty kind of, I mean, given as we were saying where we are at the moment, we're at 96, that makes all of these things really look pretty commercially attractive right now. Now, I mean, I see Pete is still in the audience. Pete Slaby from Shell still here. You know, I'm not wanting to pick on you, but when you think about what Shell has done, Shell has spent now $4.5 billion for the getting ready for the drilling campaign and the trip in the Beaufort Seas, and they've not drilled a single well yet. When you think about that cost, the enormous commitment of money and time and effort that's made, I mean, I'm not sure if Pete were to go to his board today and say, you know, good news, guys, I've got this plan to drill a well, but it's going to cost $4.5 billion before we can get one well drilled. I'm not sure how welcome he would be. And so I think that's the thing which is really kind of shaking up calculations in the whole of the oil market. I think, I mean, there's other factors going on as well, which in terms of increased supply from other countries. We heard, for instance, about East Africa being opened up as a new gas producer. There's also a lot of interest in West Africa in terms of increased oil production. There are other places in the world that are also thinking about big increases in oil production being available there, such as Iraq, for instance. Iraq, which obviously, don't need to tell anyone here about the history of it, but Iraq has now overtaken Iran in terms of oil production. They've had very steep growth just in the past year. They're now doing more than 3 million barrels a day. It's quite possible they could be doing 4, 5, 6, 7 million barrels a day by some point. According to some estimates, that country has the largest oil reserves of any country in the world. And so there's potential competition in terms of oil supplies to Alaskan production from a lot of places. And again, to kind of echo, in a way, some of the themes that Charles was bringing out, there is a lot of oil elsewhere in the world that could come on. There's also potential weakness in demand, and I think this is going to be one of the big emerging stories probably over the next couple of years. We're hearing a lot of now bad economic news out of China. China has really been the engine that's kept the world economy going and has certainly kept commodity demand going. And a very interesting statement we had from the Australian government last week where they're saying, yeah, our commodity boom is over. That big cycle of I mean, obviously, in Australia, more they're thinking about mining and minerals, but they're also thinking about gas as well. And they're saying the way that they could rely on kind of infinite demand from China, China being the customer of last resort that could always buy as much as they wanted to produce, that's over. That's not there anymore. Stockpiles are piling up in China. It's starting to affect the mining industry very significantly. I think it's very likely that will start to affect the oil industry as well. We may see quite a long period of weakness and slack demand in the oil business, which again will make a lot of these kind of economics look much less attractive. More harsh realities. I'm sorry to be kind of gloomy and cautious about this, but as I say, I think that that's something which is important for everyone to think about. I think conversely, I would say that in the long term, I think this region, this state has a fantastic future. I think, you know, the resources are there and they're not going away. And at some point, the world will want them. And I think it was David Rubenstein made that point about, you know, what we need is a crisis. And I think, unfortunately, he's probably absolutely right. And if you look back at the history of Alaska, this was a state, it's not really an exaggeration to say that this was the state that saved the world in the 1970s when OPEC had the world by the throat in the two oil shocks of 73, 74, and then 79, 80. It was thanks to the huge expansion of oil production here, the opening up of Alaska for oil production that really broke the power of OPEC then. And we had two decades of low global oil prices, economic success and stability really around the world, very largely thanks to the contribution that Alaska made. But I think probably that's what it's going to take again. It's going to be some kind of crisis like that. I mean, and there's been again talk here today about how it's hard to get the state's voice heard in Washington, D.C. People don't kind of take the state's interests seriously enough, and I can kind of see why that is, and I can appreciate that's a problem for you, but I am absolutely confident there will be a time when the rest of the world is very, very glad that Alaska exists, and I'm sure you won't have any trouble at all in getting your voice heard then. Thanks very much.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Ed Crooks, U.S. Industry and Energy Editor for the Financial Times. Before Mr. Crooks, you heard from the Honorable Charlotte Brower, Mayor of the North Slope Borough, and Rear Admiral Thomas Ostebo, Commander of the 17th District U.S. Coast Guard. They were three of six who participated in the panel discussion on sustainable development in the Arctic, recorded at the Arctic Imperative Summit in Girdwood on August 26, 2012. Alaska Dispatch hosted the Arctic Imperative Summit at Alyeska Resort in Girdwood. They also provided audio for this four-part series on KSKA, as well as a complete online video archive of the conference. If you would like to listen to the second half of the panel you heard today on sustainable development in the Arctic, you can find a link at alaskapublic.org. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.